I'm Austin Meek with Waco Business News, and you're listening to Downtown Depot, where we track the ins and outs of Waco business. My guest today is Megan Henderson. Megan serves as the Executive Director of City Center Waco, a nonprofit that connects communities, developers, and the city to bring about inclusive and equitable development in our neighborhoods. We discuss the city's strategic goals and take a walk along the Elm Avenue corridor, which Megan expects to look very different in the coming months. But before that conversation, it's the word on the street. The Turner Barringer development at University Parks Drive and Mary Avenue Market continues to make waves. Just last weekend, Ashley Futris opened Bolt Boutique, a clothing and lifestyle store with an edgy vibe. Bolt has plenty for both locals and tourists, with tons of Waco-themed apparel that's a bit sassier than I've seen in other retailers. My favorite shirt was an illustration of Jacob's Ladder there at Cameron Park, with the phrase, "I'd climb that," underneath it. David Gorham, the owner of Honky Tonk Kid Barbecue, is set to start work on a 1,000-square-foot restaurant on the other side of Bolt's building. Davey's been operating as a food truck for the past couple years and is finally making the jump into a brick and mortar. And in that same development, Rush Cycles and its 43 fitness bikes are now hosting classes. A Japanese crepe and Thai ice cream spot called J-Pedal is soon to be online. And a new concept called Putters will take 5,000 square feet. Addressing the need for more family-friendly entertainment in downtown, owner Sean Reesing said the space will feature a miniature golf course, video game arcade, and sports bar with at least 25 TVs. Reesing also owns Trojan Cork and Keg, another bar in the area. I'm now joined in studio by Austin Hooper for a new monthly segment called The Residential Recap. Austin is a realtor at AG Real Estate and has a real good pulse on the markets in Waco's housing sector. So, Austin, thank you so much for coming on Downtown Depot.
Thank you, Austin.
And give me an idea of what the Waco housing market was before the Magnolia event. I know Chip and Joanna's greatness has skewed a lot of prices, but let's say like 2013, 2014, what was the market looking like in Waco?
Sure. So, yeah, 2013, 2014, when I look at that, so first of all, that's when I moved back to Waco. My wife and I got married and moved here in the fall of 2013. That's when I started doing real estate, and that was really the point before what we would call the, you know, Magnolia effect on Waco and certainly Waco real estate. 2014. The average sales price of a home in McLennan County was around $155,000.
Okay.
Looking at year to date for 2018, the average sale price for a house in McLennan County is $210,000. So clearly a significant increase. It's 35% increase since 2014.
Wow. So, I mean, that sounds like a huge jump. Is that reflective of Texas in general just has a great housing market, or is that really a Waco-specific number?
Yeah, I think it's three things. One, Texas in general, yes. A lot of people moving to Texas, market values increasing in Texas. And I guess we could zoom out and just look at the U.S. as a whole. There's sort of a rebound or a correction from the market crash in 2008. Waco specifically, yes, the Magnolia effect is very real. I also think a big part of it for Waco was just a correction that had needed to happen. I think Waco was just straight up undervalued for a long time. And so this drastic increase is, yes, certainly just the Waco becoming a cool place to live and people are wanting to move here. And so that's naturally going to drive up prices, especially when you have sort of the supply and demand issues that we're having right now. But especially those first couple years, the 2014 to 2016, we saw a big jump. And I think a lot of that was just a correction in value that needed to take place, if that makes sense.
What are the hottest neighborhoods in Waco right now?
Right now, I would say, and this has changed a little bit over the last couple of years, a lot of the people that I'm working with, specifically buyers moving into the Waco market, want to be in Waco proper. They want to be close to downtown. They want to be in where the action is happening.
And that was not always the case.
Not always the case. And, you know, of course, you still have other folks moving to town that want to be in China Spring ISD or Midway ISD or what have you. That is certainly still a thing. But the increase in popularity of Waco proper over the last 2-3 years has been significant. And Waco proper is where we are seeing supply and demand most out of whack. So lots of demand, not a ton of supply.
In Waco proper.
In Waco proper. Okay. Primary reason for that is going to be there's nowhere else to build, really.
Right. So in these bedroom communities, your Lorenas, Woodways, Hewitts, there's still a lot of room for growth.
Correct. And we have actually just a couple weeks ago in the most recent Greater Waco Economic Index that the Waco Trib puts out each month, great resource. We are shattering records, they're saying, as far as new construction happening in those surrounding communities. So your Lorenas, China Spring, McGregor, Crawford. So the supply and demand issue is being corrected a bit out in those areas, but we don't have that luxury here in Waco proper. You don't have big swaths of land where you can, you know, carve out 500 lots and build 500 new homes.
You're hearing from Austin Hooper, realtor with AG Real Estate. He's going to be joining us every month on Downtown Depot to give us a recap of the residential markets. Austin, thank you so much for stopping by the show.
Thank you. See you soon.
I'm now joined in studio by Megan Henderson. Megan is the executive director of City Center Waco. Thanks for stopping by Downtown Depot.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Tell me a little bit about your Waco history, Megan.
Well, my husband and I moved to Waco in 2009. We had both been working in town for some time, and we brought our family and moved into the Dean Highland neighborhood and have lived here ever since. But I grew up in Hillsboro, so Waco was the big city for me growing up.
Is Hillsboro experiencing any of this sort of revitalization like we're seeing in Waco?
They're seeing quite a bit. Now, it's not entirely the same trend. You know, Hillsboro is a very different kind of town, so they're not necessarily seeing the return to downtown from suburbs and things like that. But what they are seeing are more and more people moving to Hillsboro, and I attribute that in part to Waco becoming a greater destination. You know, being 45 minutes away from Waco means a lot more now than it did when I was growing up, for sure.
And that's a trend that we're seeing play out along the I-35 corridor, really. I was in Waxahachie a few weeks ago, stopped into the Webb Art Gallery, which is terrific folk art. But I was so surprised at how developed the downtown Waxahachie was. And there is this family, the Lake family, that's gone in and bought a lot of property there. And it does seem that a lot of progress is spurting out from Waco and affecting the corridor.
Sure. I did, you know, before coming to work for City Center Waco, I did a lot of work directly for and then through the Council of Governments with rural communities. And I really kind of felt like I could help rural communities almost more by making downtown Waco and Waco a fantastic attraction than by working with them directly on their streets and their water lines.
You've been working for the city of Waco since 2012 or so?
Well, on behalf of the city of Waco. Now, City Center Waco is a standalone nonprofit, but I've been working for City Center Waco since 2012.
Okay. And that used to be a group called the Downtown Development Corps, is that what it was? Kind of explain the history and where you are now with City Center.
Yeah. So City Center Waco, really, you know, kind of one of our two parent corporations was the Waco Downtown Development Corporation, which was created out of the Imagine Waco plan. Imagine Waco in 2010 said, you know, you really need a small, nimble organization to help catalyze development. And then they spent probably 2011 really working out how that was going to go. They created a board that represents a broad range of stakeholders who don't necessarily see the world exactly the same. And that created a board that then had a lot to say to each other and with each other about who to hire and what the direction the corporation should go in. And so they had really done a lot of that kind of soul searching and brought me on board in September of 2012.
If you're a Downtown Depot listener interested in things of the city and haven't taken the time to read through Imagine Waco, I would suggest it. I've spent a lot of time digging into that document the last year, and it's really interesting to see the goals that were laid out in 2010, 2011. And you can see there was a big panel, and we interviewed people from North Waco or East Waco, and you can see all these different people's responses and then see how those responses were changed into policy.
Yeah, yeah. It was the most participated in planning effort that the city of Waco had ever undertaken, and really remains the guiding force behind development in downtown. It undergirds TIF funding decisions and planning and zoning decisions and creates the basis for the downtown overlay. I mean, it really is integrated into decision making at the city on lots of levels, and certainly informs everything that we do at originally the Downtown Development Corporation, kind of merged with the Business Resource Center, and then the two corporations became one and is now called City Center Waco.
2011 was before the Magnolia event. So if they were writing it today, it might look a little bit different. What are the ways, looking back on that document, that you see the city has played out really true to form? The way we thought it was going to look in 2011 is the way it looks now. And what are some ways in which maybe the city hasn't achieved the goals that were set out in 2011, and how can we find a way to meet those?
Sure. So Imagine Waco is a vision document, and it outlines the qualities that we're going for in downtown, we've been saying downtown, but Imagine Waco and City Center Waco both cover an area that's much broader. Mm-hmm. So downtown and the surrounding neighborhoods, which is what we call the city center. So Imagine Waco talks about achieving the types of densities that really make a downtown flourish, as well as the types of densities, and I mean bringing people back into the area, that really make the city's investment in infrastructure make sense. So, you know, if you build out a bunch of infrastructure and then you have fewer people there than that infrastructure is meant to support, then you're probably losing money on those sunk costs, right? So Imagine Waco says, let's bring the people back into these spaces in multi-story mixed-use buildings in downtown, in single-family, you know, beautiful new and also historic neighborhoods in the surrounding neighborhoods. So there are a few places where Imagine Waco says, in this space, we envision this type of development. But more broadly, it talks about sort of principles that need to be worked into decision making. So plant more trees, invest in sidewalks and connectivity, use multiple different types of housing development of different sizes and prices. Lots of these kinds of processes. And so what we've seen is the market really begin to do and deliver the kinds of product that Imagine Waco envisions. So we've seen a real blossoming of residential in downtown when in, you know, 2010, 2011, that was really not a thing that the market was doing. It certainly wasn't doing the types of mixed use, you know, retail and commercial on the ground floor and, you know, either rental or condo living up above. And we've seen not only that happen, but, you know, an average of 80 units per year delivered and continue to be, you know, 90, 95% occupied, really moving very well.
The city had commissioned a Denver-based consulting group to take a look at Waco and see ways in which it might grow. Their findings that I think they released this about a month ago were that the city should not incentivize development along I-35 and Baylor student housing, and that they should work towards connecting East Waco with downtown, with uptown, with the riverfront development, with the silos. What were your thoughts on those findings?
Well, so the market study, this was a TIF market study funded by the TIF board to guide the sorts of investments that the TIF will be making throughout the rest of its expected life. And, you know, I'm struck by the degree to which all of the existing planning material really reinforces itself. So there are certainly are places, as you mentioned earlier, like the stadium and Magnolia, that were undreamt of in the philosophy of the Imagine Waco plan. But each plan, so Imagine Waco at closer to the beginning and the TIF market study closer to the end, with things like the Main Street assessment and downtown transit studies and corridor studies and lots of different things in the middle that all treat downtown and emphasize different things to answer different questions. they all emphasize connectivity. They have increasingly identified the need to develop specific districts so that you can build on strengths and achieve an economy of scale. You've got to try to aggregate good things that are happening so that people really get a sense of a good, rich experience around them. Otherwise, in the 111 blocks or so that comprise what we think of when we say downtown, it would be easy for the effect to really dissipate and not be felt. They also really point to some of the things in Imagine Waco and since then that have been a little bit harder to get going. And some of those include what I would consider purely public investments in infrastructure, public space, and improvements in downtown. So the way that the TIF has operated for the last several years has been to augment private sector development. You know, there was a time when there was the concern we don't want to build a bridge to nowhere, a sidewalk to nowhere. We don't want to put something in and then a development comes and we have to tear it all out. Mm-hmm. And so investments were made very cautiously alongside and literally adjacent to private sector development projects. You know, so you would build a building or rehabilitate a building and TIF would do the sidewalks right in front of you. Well, the unintended consequence of that is that you get lots of places with where the sidewalk is almost like the front porch. It's really pretty right in front, maybe a little bit to the side of your business, but you got cute, crummy, and it makes for a difficult connection experience, especially, and now, you know, it's hard to imagine just a few years ago, but now you see families with strollers and shopping bags trying to haul their way along areas where the sidewalk is really bad or there's not a sidewalk at all. And so the TIF market study really says, hey, why don't you think about a set-aside? Think about allocating maybe 25% or so of upcoming TIF revenues and really devoting that to just a public sector project. So, you know, nobody's building a development next door, but where we have cute over here and cute over here and five blocks of crummy sidewalks in between, let's just put in those sidewalks.
You're hearing from Megan Henderson, Executive Director of City Center Waco, which is a group that acts as a liaison between private developers and the city. They're also going out and speaking with stakeholders in these neighborhoods to make sure that the development that happens around them is happening with them and not simply to them. You guys have been parked in East Waco on Elm Avenue for a few years now, and we hear a lot about East Waco and the revitalization of Elm. Can you walk us down that strip? Walk us from Elm Avenue right there at MLK and the river and kind of give us an idea for what we might be seeing in as much as you can reveal the plans that are happening there. But kind of give us an idea of this wave of culture and art and fun that could be coming to the east side.
Sure, sure. So the first thing that I want to point out is that just like in the rest of downtown, the things that are happening in Elm Avenue are happening in part as a result of some investments that have been made, you know, earlier on. So TIF investments in the Quinn campus, smaller facade improvements at Maryland's Gift Gallery and the Jockey Club. You know, we've started to see kind of longer term property owners on Elm kind of look around and say, downtown's starting to do some stuff. Maybe it's time for us to start to do some stuff as well. Certainly, the impact of Lula Jane's has been very, very strong in luring people across the river for some fantastic food who might otherwise not have ventured that way. It has not been that long ago, you know, when people really were reluctant to cross the river, and now it is just not a thing. And so what people experience when they take that trip across one of the beautiful bridges is they experience a place that is close to downtown but has a completely different feel. They experience people who love where they are and really celebrate the corridor of Elm Avenue, and the history of the place is just almost palpable. Mm. It feels like a significant place because it is. Elm has a strong and unique place in the hearts of much of Waco's community, and for that reason continues to be kind of a big priority and a heart project as well as a head and pocketbook project.
And historically, Elm Avenue was part of the Chisholm Trail, right?
Sure. So originally, the suspension bridge was in the middle of Bridge Street, Bridge Street was on both sides of the river, and it started at City Hall. So Austin Avenue hit City Hall, and then on the other side became Bridge Street, and then the suspension bridge, and then Bridge Street carried forward. So that crossing was along Bridge Street, which eventually joins up with Elm Avenue a couple of blocks down. Elm was the continuation of Washington, which was another early thoroughfare, and you can see the historic photographs are fantastic of the development along Elm and Bridge Streets.
So take us up to present day. So now it's 2018. Lula Jane's has been one of those aggregators you were talking about. Mm-hmm. Maryland's Gift Gallery, Tony DiMaria's, down a little bit further towards Clifton, Jasper's Barbecue, and of course the Jockey Club. I've featured them on a Small Business Spotlight video earlier this year.
Oh, great.
But yeah, sort of take us into the present and with a look in the next couple of years, what should we expect? Brotherwell Brewing has now opened up on Bridge Street. Really cool craft brewery there.
Yeah. So there are a handful of things that are happening right now. Nancy Grayson is opening a market, Elm Avenue Grocery, and Travis and Danielle Young are opening an eatery, Revival Eatery, right next door. Those are both in the 700 block. Also in the 700 block, a really cute little historic building is being redeveloped by Anthony Billings and Rodney Clark. Half of that is proposed to be a dance studio. The other half will be available as commercial space. So that's the 700 block. On the other side of the 700 block is 713 Elm, the building most recently belonging to the Eastern Waco Development Corporation, which has sold to an entity that has been known as CrossFit Waco, but is rebranding as Train Waco. And so in that block, the 700 block, there's basically one building, one huge building on one side of the street, and three small buildings on the other side of the street. All four of those buildings are under redevelopment right now. CrossFit is set to be open in the next week or so. The grocery and Revival are slated to be open February-ish of 2019, and the smaller commercial building probably closely on their heels. So that's just an example of something that when you drive by right now, you wouldn't necessarily see a big change, but the big changes are happening and they're in the works. Huge changes, things that you do see when you drive by right now, include the railroad property, and I forget the exact acreage, but what was called the depot property goes between Bridge and Taylor Streets and is a huge area that has always been, you know, really kind of thickly wooded and forbidding looking. Now that area has been cleared. There are a few really gorgeous old trees that are hopefully being preserved, and that area will develop into a couple of different hotels. We're not free to release those flags as of yet, but we're really excited about both the quality and the quantity of rooms that will be offered. There may even be some more development on the adjacent previously railroad-owned tract that is bounded by kind of Tejas Logistics and Taylor and MLK on the other side of Taylor from the big tract.
And this is the same hotel group that did the Hotel Indigo, correct?
That's right.
Cool. What makes a good neighborhood? I live in Dean Highland, similar to you, and if I want to make sure that Dean Highland is the greatest, most friendly, pedestrian, cool spot, are there any things that I could do just as an individual to make a good neighborhood, or is making a quote-unquote good neighborhood all policy-driven?
I think that it is equally important to have good policy and good individual action. And I think that there are people who would say either is enough by itself. I think that there are plenty of people in the world who absolutely love their neighborhoods because of who is there and how they interact with one another and what that does for their quality of life, even if everything around is really not that great. Mm-hmm. Likewise, I think that there are people who choose neighborhoods and buy houses in particular neighborhoods because of how well managed and how well designed they are, and they may be perfectly happy with that choice and never have a conversation with the guy who crossed the fence. But I think the best neighborhoods for me are definitely those with both. And I think that it's really important that neighborhood associations in Waco be understood as a tool to really achieve both of those ends. Because neighborhood associations not only help you meet your neighbors and understand what you have in common with, even if they're, you know, a block or two down. You know, I know everybody across the street and next door to me, but a block or two down, it starts to get fuzzy. A neighborhood is really more than the two houses next to me and me. So neighborhood associations help with socialization in that way, but they also really have a voice in the way that cities develop, especially the way in Waco develops, because boards like the Planning and Zoning Commission and the Zoning Board of Adjustment and certainly the City Council really value the input that comes from neighborhood associations. They really speak for the community, and our city government is one that listens and makes different decisions based on what those neighborhoods say.
I will affirm that the city of Waco, whether it's working with you or other officials at the city, I have always been really thrilled and felt so heard by the fact that someone is sitting across the table from me and they're hearing what I'm saying, and then I can see implementations of some of those things, at least in the small interactions that I've had. When I had Andrea Bearfield on here a few months ago, she was just leaving the City Center Waco group with you. And she had talked really about the idea of City Center Waco and what its goal is. And I'll get you out of here on this. She had mentioned that East Waco is where City Center was now, but there are plenty of other worthy areas in Waco that are in need of a little bit of development help. She had mentioned the LaSalle Corridor, 24th and 25th. I'm sure there's a number of different places. What should we expect for next moves from City Center Waco once Elm is really up and running and you guys are looking to spread the love elsewhere?
Well, I think I might add some characteristics to that outline that you've given, which is great. We really are not treating this as a sequence. You know, it's not the kind of thing where I get this all finished and spinning and then I move on to this next thing.
Oh, okay.
Because communities aren't waiting. So the LaSalle Corridor, for example, has engaged us to walk them through a development planning process because they perceive that changes are afoot down that corridor.
Regardless of them being involved or not. They know it's happening and we want to get
right
in front of it.
So Magnolia Table is happening. There's a shuttle that's going. All of a sudden, we've got pedestrians trying to navigate LaSalle, which is a very, very vehicularly oriented corridor. So we're walking them through a process that's going to involve potential recommendations for a new overlay treating form and content of development of the corridor, and a sort of light version of a corridor study that will be, again, coordinated by us, the public participation process, but the expertise will come from in-house at the city because they've got a crackerjack team of traffic engineers that really produce great work. So LaSalle is getting a jump on future development in that way. We've had a similar engagement beginning with Uptown, where Uptown really is trying to articulate who they are, where they are, what that means, and then how to build on that and make Uptown even more successful. In the Elm community, we're there as a physical neighbor, but our physically being there doesn't necessarily qualify us to be more of and for Elm than other places. We are, you know, trying to serve where we're called to serve by those communities. And in each case, Elm is certainly a great example. It's the businesses, the property owners, the residents of those corridors and those communities that really are the driving force. And we are just the connective tissue and a little bit of manpower trying to put legs and arms to what they're trying to do.
Well, you're doing a great job of connecting that East Waco community with the rest of Waco, and really grateful for your time today. And thank
pleasure.
You so much for your work that you're doing for the city. So Megan Henderson, Executive Director of City Center Waco, thank you so much for coming by Downtown Depot.
My pleasure. Thanks, Austin.
Thanks again to Megan Henderson, Austin Hooper with the Residential Recap, and to you for tuning in, whether here on KWBU or online via Apple Podcasts or the NPR One app. We really appreciate the support and would love to hear from you. So connect with Waco Business News on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. I'm Austin Meek with Waco Business News, and you've been listening to Downtown Depot, where we track the ins and outs of Waco business.